You're listening to LawPod UK from the creators of the UK Human Rights Blog. It's a podcast that discusses developments across all aspects of civil and public law in the United Kingdom. All the comments are current at the time of podcast publication. LawPod UK is produced by the barristers at 1 Crown Office Row and is presented by Rosalind English.
Today we'll be talking about a relatively new criminal offence, which was introduced in 2015 and is only now working its way out through the courts. It's set out under Section 76 of the Serious Crime Act and covers controlling or coercive behaviour in an intimate or family relationship. Claire Chibarovska is a specialist family practitioner in the Brighton Annex of 1 Crown Office Row. She covered the subject recently in a talk given to the Worthing Law Society. Claire, can you explain what kind of behaviour this offence is aimed at?
In terms of certainly family law and also to a large extent criminal law, the definition of coercive behaviour, it is essentially an act or a pattern of acts of assault, threats, humiliation and intimidation or other abuse that's used to harm, punish or frighten the victim. And then controlling behaviour means an act or pattern of acts designed to make a person subordinate or dependent by isolating them from sources of support, exploiting their resources and capacities for personal gain, depriving them of the means needed for independence, and regulating their everyday behaviour.
This is a form of psychological bullying, almost, that doesn't always result in injury, and criminal law focuses on discrete incidents of abuse rather than patterns of behaviour, so it's subtly different, isn't it?
There is, and I think it's obviously a lot easier to prove incidents of physical assault, because there will be inevitably injuries, hospital or medical attendance by the victim. And it's often easier to show that somebody's been the victim of physical abuse. Certainly in the family courts, the term domestic violence has been replaced with the term domestic abuse. And that is to recognise this more subtle form, which is more psychological in nature. And it may not be a very obvious one-off incident. It may be a pattern of incidents. For example, somebody coming home and the abusive person, for example, not being happy with the way the house has been cleaned. But it may not on that occasion lead to any sort of obvious abuse. But if that person is coming home on a daily basis and being heavily critical about, for example, cleaning the home, and that happens on a daily basis, and the victim is left to wonder what the reprisals might be for failing to comply to the standard that the abuser has set, then that indicates a much more subtle form of psychological abuse. And it can happen over a number of days, weeks, months and even years in some cases, rather than it being a sort of one-off obvious act of violence that can often be evidenced by injuries.
Can we back up a bit and just explain how this transfers from the criminal courts to the family courts? Because obviously this is a criminal offence. So, and the family procedure has now incorporated this offence in the background of the various orders it can make. But can you explain how it has crossed over?
Yes, and so in 2015, the criminal offence was introduced for controlling and coercive behaviour. And that is an offence that's punishable by up to 5 years imprisonment. And I think there have been some successful prosecutions already under that criminal offence. When we look at domestic abuse in family proceedings, there are different applications where it might become relevant. So, for example, applications for parents to see their children, if there are allegations of domestic abuse, the courts will need to work out whether those allegations are relevant to whether or not a child sees a parent. And so if somebody has been prosecuted successfully under the criminal law and there's a conviction, then that is evidence of itself of domestic abuse, of coercive and controlling nature, and that is highly relevant to any decision in the family context. But certainly the family courts for many years have been able to look at this type of behaviour to see whether it's relevant to child arrangements. But it's only really since the introduction of the criminal offence in 2015 that there's been more of a focus by the family courts. And there's been an updated practice direction that practitioners must refer to. It's practice direction 12J, which sets out how to help identify incidents of coercive and controlling behaviour. And if there are those types of allegations, that the court must try and deal with that within the proceedings.
There are obviously evidential difficulties in this area because by the very nature of this kind of behaviour, the victim is not going to be very vocal. So how did the courts go about, or the social workers involved go about, finding and establishing evidence?
It's very difficult to identify these types of behaviours. Obviously, again, if somebody has a physical injury, they might visit their GP and there might be questions asked that might lead that person to seek further support. But where it's coercive control and manipulation and psychological abuse, a person may not necessarily come into contact with professionals who are able to help them identify those incidents of psychological abuse. And so often a person will remain in an abusive relationship for many years. It's at the point of separation where a person realises quite the extent of how much abuse they've been suffering. The job can fall to family solicitors and barristers from speaking to clients and trying to identify why, for example, somebody may be opposed to an ex-partner seeing the children. Quite often, a mother in those circumstances, if it's an abusive father, will be very reluctant to agree to that father having direct contact with the children if they've been exposed to a household of really serious domestic violence and domestic abuse. And so when it's only when questioning and probing a little bit on behalf of the lawyers, do accounts then start coming out?
And I suppose in other kinds of coercive behaviour, you gave the example of taking over control of somebody's money and bank accounts. You've got that paper trail of evidence.
Yes, it can do. So if somebody has no control over their own bank accounts and there's evidence perhaps of child benefit payments or any of the other money going through the abuser's account, then that can be something that you can use to evidence how little of the person's money that they were themselves receiving. But sometimes, again, it's more subtle than that. So the abuser might, for example, demand that the victim hands over money after, for example, after a payment day. But I think the financial abuse side of things extends also to an abuser declaring that the victim is not allowed to have independence by obtaining their own job, for example.
OK, so once you've got coercive and controlling behaviour established, how does the court proceed?
So if there is a finding by the family court following a hearing, which I should say is often the family courts will be required to conduct what's called a fact-finding hearing, which will be similar to a criminal trial. But within the family proceedings, of course, the judge only has to find an allegation proved on the balance of probability rather than beyond all reasonable doubt. And so a fact-finding hearing, often the only evidence is that of the parties themselves. And this, again, can place a vulnerable person who's been the victim of domestic abuse in a very difficult situation where they are expected to give details of sometimes very personal and very hurtful information that they about the abuse that they've experienced. And so that hearing itself can often be a very difficult hearing and sometimes leads to a person feeling that they can't go through with that type of hearing. And then it's a difficult balance between trying to persuade somebody to give evidence about the abuse they've suffered and making sure that there's consideration of their own mental well-being. But assuming somebody does take the decision to go to a fact-finding hearing, and assuming that allegations are then proven, the court's role doesn't stop there in family proceedings. What the court will then look at is whether it's to look at the effect of any domestic abuse on the child and on the arrangements for where the child is living. But also now what the practice direction stipulates is that the court must also look on the effect of the domestic abuse not only on the child, but on the effect of the child's main carer. And so that's something that has changed recently, and it's recognised that the effect of ongoing domestic abuse, for example, post-separation, and if there is existence of that type of abuse ongoing, that the impact on the child's parent of that could be extremely damaging. And that in itself could be a factor where the courts may say that there should be no contact between a child and an abusive parent. But if the person who is found to have been abusive in the relationship is not motivated by a desire to continue the abuse and are in some ways accepting of the need for help, then the court can make a referral to a domestic violence perpetrators programme, which is usually run by or in conjunction with probation services. And it's a specific programme targeting abusers to ensure that they can change their patterns of behaviour. And hopefully the expectation is they gain insight of the effects of how their controlling and coercive behaviour have been on the whole family, and to make sure that if any contact between a child and a parent is ordered in the future, that it is safe for that child.
Does this new focus of the court on this more subtle kind of abuse create particular sensitive difficulties in certain cultural situations?
Absolutely. And I think where there are additional cultural dimensions to a case, that again, it may not be immediately obvious to any practitioner that there are potentially incidents of this more subtle type of psychological abuse. What will always happen in any children's case is that the CAFCAS, the Court Advisory and Family Service, will ensure that there are safeguarding checks undertaken before any application comes to court. And the CAFCAS officers, who are experienced family court advisors, will interview both parties on the telephone before the first hearing, and will also have an officer of CAFCAS available at a first hearing in a family case. So the CAFCAS officers, I understand, have received additional training to try and identify whether there are elements of coercive control. They are more skilled in being able to interview somebody to see if these issues are evident. And they're also more skilled at trying to identify whether there are any cultural aspects to the situation that become relevant. For example, if somebody has had an arranged marriage and wants to separate from that person, there are often other factors such as the role of both of the families in those circumstances that may not appear immediately obvious.
Finally, I think we ought to make clear that this coercive and controlling behaviour is a matter of the adult carers, the parents, whatever. Although it affects the child, it's not focused on the child. Could you get a case in the family courts involving this coercive and controlling behaviour where there's no child?
Yes, so in other cases where the parties haven't made an application about spending time with a child, we do see this type of situation in injunctions. And so under the Family Law Act, a person can apply for what we call a non-molestation order, which is an injunction to prohibit and prevent somebody from acting in an intimidating, harassing or abusive or violent way. And those types of applications are between two individuals and don't have to necessarily relate to a child. And so the definition of domestic abuse and the definition of molestation are very similar, but a person doesn't have to show that the behaviour is necessarily criminal behaviour, just that it's pestering, harassing, and that an order of the court is necessary to stop somebody from acting towards another person in that way. And the effect of that order, if an injunction is made, is that there is an automatic power of arrest attached to it. So if somebody is then found to be in breach of a non-molestation order, then they will be arrested immediately and taken into police custody. And the offence is then a criminal offence for breaching a non-molestation order.
Claire, thank you. You've covered it very well, and we're now much enlightened as to this new form of court intervention in family lives. So thank you very much for coming on the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
LawPod UK is presented by Rosalind English and produced by One Crown Office Row. For more editions of LawPod UK, you can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes and recommend us to a friend.